"You knew," he says without looking at her, keeping his attention on the teapot as he pours. "We are two different people, Ethan. Just because you could never decide which one of us you were in love with does not make us interchangeable." He puts down the pot and prepares her tea, knowing how she takes it without having to ask. "I asked you to marry me, and you never gave me an answer," he says as he stirs. "You asked me after she died," Lainey says. "How could I ever be certain that was a choice you made, or one that was made for you?" He hands her the cup of tea, resting his hand over hers as she takes it. "I love you," he says. "I loved her as well, but it was never the same. You are as dear as family to me, all of you. More dear, in some cases." He returns to his chair, removing his spectacles to wipe them with his handkerchief. "I don't know why I wear these things," he says, looking down at them. "I haven't needed them for years." "You wear them because they suit you," Lainey says. "Thank you," he says as he replaces them, watching her as she sips her tea. "That offer still stands." "I know," Lainey says. "I am considering it." "Take your time," Mr. Barris says. "We appear to have a great deal of it." Lainey nods, placing her teacup on the desk. "Tara was always the rational, sensible one," she says. "We balanced each other. That was one of the reasons we excelled at whatever we did. She grounded my imaginative ideas. I saw in details while she saw in scope. Not seeing the scope is why I am here and she is not. I took each element separately and never looked to see that they did not fit together properly." The clock ticks heavily through the pause that follows. "I don't want to have this conversation," Mr. Barris says once the ticking becomes insufferable. "I didn't want to have it with her then, and I do not want to have it with you now." "You know what's going on here, don't you?" Lainey asks. Mr. Barris straightens a pile of papers on his desk while he considers his response. "Yes," he says after a moment, "I do." "Did you tell my sister?" "No." "Then tell me," Lainey says. "I cannot. To explain would involve breaking a trust, and I am not willing to do that, not even for you." "How many times have you lied to me?" Lainey asks, rising from her chair. "I have never lied," Mr. Barris counters, standing as well. "I do not share what I am not at liberty to say. I gave my word, and I intend to keep it, but I have never lied to you. You never even asked me. You assumed I knew nothing." "Tara asked you," Lainey says. "Indirectly," Mr. Barris says. "I do not think she knew what to ask, and I would not have answered if she did. I was concerned about her, and I suggested that she speak with Alexander if she wanted answers. I assume that was why she was at the station. I do not know if she ever spoke to him. I have not asked." "Alexander knows as well?" Lainey asks. "I believe there is little, if anything, that he is ignorant about." Lainey sighs and returns to her chair. She picks up her tea, and then without taking a sip, puts it down again. Mr. Barris crosses to the other side of the desk and takes her hands in his, making sure she looks him in the eye before he speaks. "I would tell you if I could," he says. "I know that, Ethan," she says. "I do." She squeezes his hands softly to reassure him. "I don't mind this, Lainey," Mr. Barris says. "I move my office every few years. I hire a new staff. I keep up with projects through correspondence. It is not a difficult thing to manage, considering what I receive in return." "I understand," she says. "Where is the circus now?" "I'm not certain," I believe it recently left Budapest, though I do not know where it is en route to. I can find out. Friedrich will know, and I owe him a telegram. And how will Herr Thiessen know where the circus is headed? Because Celia Bowen tells him. Lainey does not ask him any further questions. Mr. Barris is relieved when she accepts the invitation to join him for dinner, and even more so when she agrees to extend her stay in Switzerland before catching up with the circus. Lainey invites Celia to join her at the Pera Palace Hotel in Constantinople as soon as she reaches the city. She waits in the tea lounge. Two lightly steaming tulip-shaped glasses with matching saucers resting upon the tile table in front of her. When Celia arrives, they greet each other warmly. Celia inquires about Lainey's journey before they discuss the city and the hotel, including the sweeping height of the room they sit within.
"It's like being in the acrobat tent," Lainey remarks, looking up at the domes that line the ceiling, each one dotted with circles of turquoise-tinted glass.
"You have not been to the circus in far too long," Celia says. "We have your costumes, if you would like to join the statues this evening."
"Thank you, but no," Lainey says. "I'm not in the mood to stand so still."
"You are welcome at any time," Celia says.
"I know," Lainey says, "though truthfully I'm not here for the circus. I am here to speak with you."
"What is it you would like to speak about?" Celia asks, a look of concern falling over her face.
"My sister was killed at St. Pancras Station after a visit to the Midland Grand Hotel," Lainey says. "Do you know why she went there?"
Celia's grip on her tea glass tightens.
"I know who she went there to see," she says, choosing her words carefully. "I suppose Ethan told you that," Lainey says.
Celia nods.
"Do you know why she wanted to see him?" Lainey asks.
"No, I do not."
"Because she didn't feel right," Lainey says. "She knew down to her bones that her world had changed, and she had received no explanation, nothing to grasp onto, to understand. I believe we have all felt similarly, and we are all dealing with it in different ways. Ethan and Tant Padva both have their work to consume their time, to keep their minds occupied. I had not concerned myself with it at all for quite a while. I loved my sister dearly, and I always will, but I think she made a mistake."
"I thought it was an accident," Celia says softly, looking down at the patterned tile on the table.
"No, before that. Her mistake was asking the wrong questions of the wrong people. It is not a mistake I plan on repeating."
"That's why you're here."
"That is why I am here," Lainey says. "How long have we known each other, Celia?"
"Over 10 years.
"Surely by now you can trust me enough to tell me what it is that's really going on here. I doubt you'd dare to tell me it is nothing, or suggest I not trouble myself with such matters."
Celia places her glass on its saucer. She explains as best she can. She keeps the details vague, covering only the basic concept of the challenge and how the circus functions as the venue. How certain people know more than others on every level, though she chooses not to name each individual and makes it clear that even she does not have all the answers. Lainey says nothing. She listens carefully and occasionally sips her tea.
"How long has Ethan known?" she asks when Celia has finished.
"A very long time," Celia says. Lainey nods and lifts her glass to her lips, but instead of sipping her tea, she opens her fingers, releasing her grip. The cup falls, crashing into the saucer below. The glass shatters, the sound echoing through the room. The tea spills out over the tiles. Before anyone turns at the noise, the cup has righted itself. The broken pieces reform around the liquid, and the glass sits intact. The tile surface of the table is dry. Those who glanced over at their table at the noise assume it was their imagination and return their attention to their own tea.
Why didn't you stop it before it broke? Lainey asks.
I don't know, Celia says.
If you ever need anything from me, I would like you to ask,
Lainey says as she stands to leave.
I am tired of everyone keeping their secrets so well that they get other people killed. We are all involved in your game, and it seems we are not as easily repaired as teacups.
Celia sits alone for some time after Lainey departs, both cups of tea growing cold. Stormy Seas, Dublin, June 1901. After the illusionist takes her bow and disappears before her rapt audience's eyes, they clap, applauding the empty air. They rise from their seats, and some of them chatter with their companions, marveling over this trick or that as they file out the door that has reappeared in the side of the striped tent. One man, sitting in the outer circle of chairs, remains in his seat as they leave. His eyes, almost hidden in the shadow cast by the brim of his bowler hat, are fixed on the space in the center of the circle that the illusionist occupied only moments before. The rest of the audience departs. The man continues to sit. After a few minutes, the door fades into the wall of the tent, invisible once more. The man's gaze does not waver. He does not so much as glance at the vanishing door. A moment later, Celia Bowen is sitting in front of him, turned to the side and resting her arms on the back of the chair. She is dressed as she had been during her performance, in a white gown covered in a pattern of unassembled puzzle pieces, falling together into darkness along the hem.
"You came to visit me," she says, unable to hide the pleasure in her voice. "I had a few days," Marco says, "and you haven't been near London recently."
"We'll be in London in the autumn," Celia says. "It's become somewhat traditional."
"I couldn't wait that long to see you."
"It's good to see you as well,"
Celia says softly. She reaches out and straightens the brim of his hat.
"Do you like the cloud maze?" he asks. He takes her hand in his as she lowers it.
"I do,"
she says, her breath catching as his fingers close over hers.
"Did you persuade our Mr. Barris to help with that?"
"I did indeed,"
Marco says, running his thumb along the inside of her wrist.
"I thought I could use some assistance in getting the balance right. Besides, you have your carousel, and we share the labyrinth. I thought it only fair that I have a Barris original of my own."
The intensity of his eyes and his touch rushes over Celia like a wave, and she takes her hand from his before it pulls her under.
"Have you come to show me your own feats of illustrious illusion?" she asks. "It was not on my agenda for the evening, but if you would like..."
"You already watched me. It would only be fair."
"I could watch you all night," he says.
"You have," Celia says. "You've been in every single audience this evening, I noticed."
She stands and walks to the center of the circle, turning so her gown swirls around her.
"I can see every seat," she says. "You are not hidden from me when you sit in the back row."
"I thought I would be too tempted to touch you if I sat in the front," Marco says, moving from his chair to stand at the edge of the circular performance space, just inside the first row of chairs.
"Am I close enough for your illusion?" she asks.
"If I say no, will you come closer?"
he retaliates, not bothering to hide his grin. In response, Celia takes another step toward him, the hem of her gown brushing over his shoes, close enough for him to lift his arm and gently rest his hand on her waist.
"You didn't have to touch me last time,"
she remarks, but she does not protest.
"I thought I'd try something special,"
Marco says.
"Should I close my eyes?"
Celia asks playfully, but instead of answering, he spins her around so she faces away from him, keeping his hand on her waist.
"Watch,"
he whispers in her ear. The striped canvas sides of the tent stiffen, the soft surface hardening as the fabric changes to paper. Words appear over the walls, typeset letters overlapping handwritten text. Celia can make out snatches of Shakespearean sonnets and fragments of hymns to Greek goddesses as the poetry fills the tent. It covers the walls and the ceiling and spreads out over the floor. And then the tent begins to open, the paper folding and tearing. The black stripes stretch out into empty space as their white counterparts brighten, reaching upward and breaking apart into branches. "Do you like it?" Marco asks, once the movement settles and they stand within a darkened forest of softly glowing, poem-covered trees. Celia can only nod. He reluctantly releases her, following as she walks through the trees, reading bits of verse on branches and trunks. "How do you come up with such images?" she asks, placing her hand over the layered paper bark of one of the trees. It is warm and solid beneath her fingers, illuminated from within like a lantern. "I see things in my mind," Marco says. "In my dreams, I imagine what you might like." "I don't think you're meant to be imagining how to please your opponent," Celia says. "I have never fully grasped the rules of the game, so I am following my instincts instead," Marco says. "My father is still purposefully vague about the rules," Celia says as they walk through the trees, "particularly when I inquire as to when or how the verdict will be determined." "Alexander also neglected to provide that information." "I hope he does not pester you as much as my father does me," Celia says, "though of course my father has nothing better to do." "I have hardly seen him in years," Marco says. "He has always been distant and not terribly forthcoming, but he is the closest thing to family I have, and yet he tells me nothing." "I'm rather jealous," Celia says. "My father constantly tells me what a disappointment I am." "I refuse to believe you could ever disappoint anyone," Marco says. "You never had the pleasure of meeting my father." "Would you tell me what really happened to him?" Marco asks. "I'm quite curious." Celia sighs before she begins, pausing beside a tree etched with words of love and longing. She has never told anyone this story, never been given the opportunity to relate it to anyone who would understand. "My father was always somewhat overambitious," she starts. "What he meant to do, he did not accomplish, not as he intended. He wanted to remove himself from the physical world." "How would that be possible?" Marco asks. Celia appreciates that he does not immediately dismiss the idea. She can see him trying to work it out in his mind as she struggles with the best way to explain it. "Suppose I had a glass of wine," she says. A glass of red wine appears in her hand. "Thank you. If I took this wine and poured it into a basin of water, or a lake, or even the ocean, would the wine itself be gone?" "No, it would only be diluted," Marco says. "Precisely," Celia says. "My father figured out a way to remove his glass." As she speaks, the glass in her hand fades, but the wine remains floating in the air. "But he went straight for the ocean, rather than a basin or even a larger glass. He has trouble pulling himself back together again. He can do it, of course, but with difficulty. Had he been content to haunt a single location, he would likely be more comfortable. Instead, the process left him adrift. He has to cling to things now. He haunts his townhouse in New York. Theatres he performed in often. He holds to me when he can, though I have learned how to avoid him when I wish to. He hates that, particularly because I am simply amplifying one of his own shielding techniques." "Could it be done?" Marco asks. "What he is attempting? Properly, I mean?" Celia looks at the wine hovering without its glass. She raises a hand to touch it and it quivers, dividing into droplets and then coming back together. "I believe it could," she says, "under the right circumstances. It would require a touchstone, a place, a tree, a physical element to hold on to. something to prevent drifting. I suspect my father simply wanted the world at large to function as his, but I believe it would have to be more localized, to function as a glass but leave more flexibility to move within. She touches the hovering wine again, pushing it toward the tree she stands beside. The liquid seeps into the paper, slowly saturating it until the entire tree glows a rich crimson in a forest of white.
"You're manipulating my illusion," Marco says, looking curiously at the wine-soaked tree.
"You're letting me," Celia says. "I wasn't certain I'd be able to."
"Could you do it?" Marco asks, what he was attempting.
Celia regards the tree thoughtfully for a moment before replying.
"If I had reason to, I think I could," she says. "But I am rather fond of the physical world. I think my father was feeling his age, which was much more advanced than it appeared, and did not relish the idea of rotting in the ground. He may also have wished to control his own destiny, but I cannot be certain, as he did not consult me before he attempted it, left me with a lot of questions to answer and a funeral to fake, which is easier than you might suppose."
"But he speaks with you?" Marco asks.
"He does, though not as often as he once did. He looks the same. I think it is an echo, his consciousness retaining the semblance of a physical form. But he lacks solidity, and it vexes him terribly. He might have been able to stay more tangible had he done it differently, though I'm not certain I'd want to be stuck in a tree for the rest of eternity myself, would you?"
"I think that would depend on the tree," Marco says.
He turns to the crimson tree, and it glows brighter, the red of embers shifting to the bright warmth of fire. The surrounding trees follow suit. As the light from the trees increases, it becomes so bright that Celia closes her eyes. The ground beneath her feet shifts, suddenly unsteady, but Marco puts a hand on her waist to keep her upright. When she opens her eyes, they are standing on the quarter-deck of a ship in the middle of the ocean. Only the ship is made of books, its sails thousands of overlapping pages, and the sea it floats upon is dark black ink. Tiny lights hang across the sky like tightly packed stars, bright as sun.
"I thought something vast would be nice after all the talk of confined spaces," Marco says.
Celia walks to the edge of the deck, running her hands along the spines of the books that form the rail. A soft breeze plays with her hair, bringing with it the mingling scent of dusty tomes and damp, rich ink. Marco comes and stands next to her as she looks at the midnight sea that stretches out into a clear horizon with no land in sight.
"It's beautiful," she says.
She glances down at his right hand resting on the rail, frowning as she regards his bare, unmarked fingers.
"Are you looking for this?" he asks, moving his hand with a flourish.
The skin shifts, revealing the scar that wraps around his ring finger.
"It was made by a ring when I was 14. It said something in Latin, but I don't know what it was."
"Esse quam videri," Celia says, "to be rather than to seem. It's the Bowen family motto. My family was very fond of engraving it on things. I'm not entirely sure he appreciated the irony. That ring was likely something like this one." She places her right hand next to his, along the adjoining books. The silver band on her finger is engraved with what Marco had thought was an intricate filigree, but it is the same phrase in a looping script. Celia twists the ring, sliding it down her finger so he can see the matching scar.
"It is the only injury I have never been able to fully heal," she says.
"Mine was similar," Marco says,
looking at her ring, though his eyes kept moving to the scar instead.
"Only it was gold. Yours was made by something of Alexander's?"
Celia nods.
"How old were you?" he asks.
"I was 6 years old,"
That ring was plain and silver. It was the first time I'd met someone who could do the things that my father did, though he seemed so very different from my father. He told me I was an angel. It was the loveliest thing anyone had ever said to me.
It is an understatement, Marco says, placing his hand over hers. A sudden breeze tugs at the layered paper sails. The pages flutter as the surface of the ink ripples below.
You did that, Marco says.
I didn't mean to, Celia says, but she does not take her hand away.
I don't mind, Marco says, entwining his fingers with hers. I can do that myself, you know.
The wind increases, sending waves of dark ink crashing into the ship. Pages fall from the sails, swirling around them like leaves. The ship begins to tilt, and Celia almost loses her footing, but Marco puts his arms around her waist to steady her while she laughs.
This is quite impressive, Mr. Illusionist, she says.
Call me by my name, he says.
He has never heard her speak his name, and holding her in his arms, he suddenly craves the sound.
Please, he adds when she hesitates. Marco, she says, her voice low and soft.
The sound of his name on her tongue is even more intoxicating than he had imagined, and he leans in to taste it. Just before his lips reach hers, she turns away.
Celia, Marco sighs against her ear,
filling her name with all the desire and frustration she feels herself, his breath hot on her neck.
I'm sorry, she says. I don't want to make this any more complicated than it already is.
He says nothing, keeping his arms around her, but the breeze begins to settle, the waves pounding against the ship become calm.
I have spent a great deal of my life struggling to keep myself in control, Celia says, leaning her head against his shoulder. To know myself inside and out, everything kept in perfect order. I lose that when I'm with you. That frightens me, and
I don't want you to be frightened, Marco interrupts.
It frightens me how much I like it,
Celia finishes, turning her face back to his.
How tempting it is to lose myself in you, to let go, to let you keep me from breaking chandeliers rather than constantly worrying about it myself.
I could.
I know.
They stand silently together as the ship drifts toward the endless horizon.
Come away with me, Marco says. Anywhere. Away from the circus, away from Alexander and your father.
We can't, Celia says.
Of course we can, Marco insists. You and I together, we could do anything.
No, Celia says. We can only do anything here.
I don't understand.
Have you ever thought about it? About simply leaving? Really, truly thought about it with the intent to follow through and not as a dream or a passing fancy?
When he does not answer, she continues,
Think about it right now. Picture us abandoning this place and this game and starting over together somewhere else, and mean it.
Marco closes his eyes and draws it out in his mind, focusing not on the wishful dream, but on the practicalities, planning out the smallest details, from organizing Chandrish's books for a new accountant to packing the suits in his flat, even down to the wedding bands on their fingers. And then his right hand begins to burn. The pain, sharp and searing, beginning at the scar around his finger and racing up his arm, blacking out every thought in his mind. It is the same pain from when the scar was made, increased a thousandfold. The motion of the ship ceases instantly. The paper crumbles, and the ocean of ink fades away, leaving only a circle of chairs inside a striped tent as Marco collapses to the floor. The pain ebbs slightly when Celia kneels next to him and takes his hand.
The night of the anniversary party, she says, the night you kissed me. I thought it that night. I didn't want to play any more. I only wanted to be with you. I thought I would ask you to run away with me, and I meant it. The very moment I convinced myself that we could manage it, I was in so much pain I could barely stand. Friedrich didn't know what to make of me. He sat me in a quiet corner and held my hand and did not pry when I couldn't explain, because that's how kind he is.
She looks down at the scar on Marco's hand as he struggles to catch his breath.
I thought perhaps it was about you, she says. So once I tried not boarding the train as it departed, and that was just as painful. We are well and truly bound.
You wanted to run away with me?
Marco says, smiling despite the lingering pain.
I wasn't sure that kiss would be quite so effective.
You could have made me forget, taken it out of my memory as easily as you did with everyone else at the party.
That was not particularly easy,
Marco says, and I did not want you to forget it.
I couldn't, Celia says. How are you feeling?
Miserable. But the pain itself is fading. I told Alexander I wanted to quit that night. I must not have meant it. I only wanted a reaction from him.
It is likely meant to make us think we are not caged, Celia says. We cannot feel the bars unless we push against them. My father says it would be easier if we did not concern ourselves so with each other. Perhaps he is right.
I've tried, Marco says, cupping her face in his hands. I have tried to let you go, and I cannot. I cannot stop thinking of you. I cannot stop dreaming about you. Do you not feel the same for me?
I do, Celia says. I have you here, all around me. I sit in the ice garden to get a hint of this way that you make me feel. I felt it even before I knew who you were. And every time I think it could not possibly get any stronger, it does.
Then what is stopping us from being together now?
He asks. He slides his hands down from her face, following the neckline of her gown.
I want to,
Celia says, gasping as his hands move lower.
Believe me, I want to. This is not only about you and me. There are so many people tangled up in this game. It's becoming more and more difficult to keep everything in order. And this,
she rests her hands over his,
this is extremely distracting. I worry what might happen if I lose my concentration.
You don't have a power source,
he says. She looks at him confused.
A power source?
She repeats.
The way I use the bonfire as a conduit, borrowing energy from the fire.
You don't have anything like that? You work only with yourself?
I don't know any other way,
Celia says.
You are constantly controlling the circus?
Marco asks. Celia nods.
I am accustomed to it. Most of the time it is manageable.
I can't imagine how exhausting that must be.
He kisses her softly on the forehead before letting her go, staying as close to her as he can without touching. And then he tells her stories, myths he learned from his instructor, fantasies he created himself, inspired by bits and pieces of others read in archaic books with crackling spines, circus concepts that would not fit in tents. She responds with tales from her childhood spent in back rooms of theatres, adventures in far-flung cities the circus has visited. She recounts events from her spiritualist days, delighted when he finds the endeavor as absurd as she had at the time. They sit and talk until just before dawn, and he leaves her only when the circus is about to close. Marco holds Celia to his chest for a moment before he stands, pulling her up with him. He takes a card from his pocket that contains only the letter M and an address.
I have been spending less time at Chandrish's residence, he says, handing her the card. When I am not there, this is where you'll find me. You are welcome any time, day or night, should you ever be in the mood for a distraction.
Thank you,
Celia says. She turns the card over in her fingers and it vanishes.
When all of this is over, no matter which one of us wins, I will not let you go so easily.
Agreed?
Agreed.
Marco takes her hand, and brings it to his lips, kissing the silver ring that conceals her scar. Celia traces the line of his jaw with her fingertips. Then she turns, disappearing before he can reach out to pull her back. An Entreaty, Concord, Massachusetts, October 30, 1902. The sheep are in a terrible mood today as Bailey attempts to usher them from one field to another. They have resisted prodding, swearing, and pushing, insisting that the grass in their current field is much nicer than the grass just on the other side of the gate in the low stone wall, no matter how much Bailey tries to persuade them otherwise. And then there is a voice behind him.
"Hello, Bailey."
Poppet looks wrong somehow, standing there on the opposite side of the wall. The daylight is too bright, the surroundings too mundane and green. Her clothes, even though they are her incognito wear and not her circus costume, seem too fancy, her skirt too ruffled for everyday wear, her boots, though dusty, too dainty and impractical for walking across a farm. She wears no hat, her red hair loose, whipping around her head in the wind.
"Hello, Poppet," he says once he recovers from his surprise. "What are you doing here?" "I needed to talk to you about something," she says. "Ask you something, I mean."
"It couldn't wait until tonight?" Bailey asks, meeting up with Poppet and Widget almost as soon as the circus opens each evening has become a nightly routine. Poppet shakes her head.
"I thought it would be better to give you time to think about it," she says.
"Think about what?"
"Think about coming with us."
Bailey blinks at her.
"What?"
he manages to ask.
"Tonight is our last night here," she says, "and I want you to come with us when we leave." "You're joking," Bailey says.
Poppet shakes her head.
"I'm not. I swear I'm not. I wanted to wait until I was sure it was the right thing to ask, the right thing to do, and I'm sure now. It's important."
"What do you mean? Important how?" Bailey asks. Poppet sighs. She looks up, peering as though she is searching for the stars hidden behind the blue sky dotted with fluffy white clouds.
"I know you're supposed to come with us," she says. "I know that part for certain."
"But why? Why me? What would I do, just tag along?
I'm not like you and Widget. I can't do anything special. I don't belong in the circus." "You do. I'm certain that you do. I don't know why yet, but I'm sure you belong with me. With us, I mean."
A scarlet blush creeps into her cheeks.
"I'd like to. I would. I just..."
Bailey looks around at the sheep, at the house, and the barn up on the hill lined with apple trees. It would either solve the argument of Harvard versus farm or make it much, much worse.
"I can't just leave," he says,
though it is not, he thinks, exactly what he means.
"I know," Poppet says. "I'm sorry. I shouldn't ask you to. But I think... No, I don't think. I know. I know that if you don't come with us, we won't be back."
"Won't be back here? Why?"
"Won't be back anywhere," Poppet says.
She raises her eyes to the sky again, scowling at it before she turns back to Bailey.
"If you don't come with us, there won't be any more circus. And don't ask me why. They don't tell me why."
She gestures at the sky, at the stars beyond the clouds.
"They just say that in order for there to be a circus in the future, you need to be there. You, Bailey, you and me and Wedge. I don't know why it's important that it's all three of us, but it is. If not, it will just crumble. It's already starting."
"What do you mean? The circus is fine."
"I'm not sure it's anything that's really noticeable from the outside. It's... If one of your sheep was sick, would I notice?"
"Probably not," Bailey says.
"But you would?" Poppet asks.
Bailey nods.
"That's how it is with the circus. I know how it's supposed to feel, and it doesn't feel like that right now, and it hasn't for a while. I can tell something's wrong, and I can feel it crumbling like cake that doesn't have enough icing to hold it together, but I don't know what it is. Does that make any sense?"
Bailey only stares at her, and she sighs before she continues.
Remember the night we were in the labyrinth, when we got stuck in the birdcage room?
Bailey nods.
I've never been stuck anywhere in the labyrinth before, never. If we can't find our way out of a room or a hall, I can focus and I can feel where the doors are. I can tell what's behind them. I try not to do it because it's not any fun that way. But that night I did when we couldn't figure it out, and it didn't work. It's starting to feel unfamiliar, and I don't know what to do about it.
But how can I do anything to help? Bailey asks.
You're the one who finally found the key, remember?
Poppet says.
I keep looking for answers, for the right thing to do, and nothing's been clear except for you. I know it's too much to ask to have you leave your home and your family, but the circus is my home and my family, and I can't lose them. Not if there's something I can do to prevent it. I'm sorry.
She sits on the rock wall, facing away from him. Bailey sits next to her, still facing the field and the incorrigible sheep. They sit in silence for a while. The sheep wander in lazy circles, nibbling on the grass.
Do you like it here, Bailey?
Poppet asks, looking out over the farm.
Not particularly, Bailey says.
Have you ever wished for someone to come and take you away?
Did Widge tell you that? Bailey asks, wondering if the thought is so strong that it sits on him, evident and readable.
No, Poppet says. It was a guess. But Widge did ask me to give you this.
She pulls a tiny glass bottle from her pocket and hands it to him. Bailey knows that though the bottle appears empty, it is likely not, and he is too curious not to open it immediately. He pulls out the minuscule stopper, relieved that it remains attached to the bottle with a curl of wire. The sensation inside is so familiar, so comforting and recognizable and real, that Bailey can feel the roughness of the bark, the smell of the acorns, even the chattering of the squirrels.
He wanted you to be able to keep your tree with you,
Poppet says,
if you decide to come with us.
Bailey replaces the stopper in the bottle. Neither of them speaks for some time. The breeze tugs at Poppet's hair.
How long do I have to think about it? Bailey asks quietly.
We're leaving when the circus closes tonight, Poppet says. The train will be ready before dawn, though it would be better if you could come earlier than that. Leaving can get a bit complicated.
I'll think about it, Bailey says. But I can't promise anything.
Thank you, Bailey,
Poppet says.
Can you do me one favor, though?
If you're not going to come with us, could you just not come to the circus tonight at all?
And let this be goodbye. I think it would be easier.
Bailey stares at her blankly for a moment, her words not quite sinking in. This is even more horrible than the choice to leave. But he nods because it feels like the proper thing to do.
All right, he says.
I won't come unless I'm going with you. I promise.
Thank you, Bailey,
Poppet says. She smiles, though he cannot tell if the smile is a happy one or not. And before he can tell her to tell Widget goodbye for him if need be, she leans forward and kisses him, not on the cheek, as she has had a handful of times before, but on the lips. And Bailey knows in that moment that he will follow her anywhere. Poppet turns without a word and walks away. Bailey watches until he can no longer see her hair against the sky, and then continues to stare after her, the tiny bottle clutched in his hand, still uncertain of how to feel or what to do, and left with only hours to decide. Behind him, the sheep, left to their own devices, decide to wander through the open gate into the field beyond. Invitation. London, October 30, 1901. When the circus arrives in London, though Celia Bowen is tempted to go immediately to the address of Marco's flat, which is printed on the card she keeps on her person at all times, she goes instead to the Midland Grand Hotel. She does not make any inquiries at the desk. She does not speak to anyone. She stands in the middle of the lobby, going unnoticed by the staff and guests that pass her on their way to other locations, other appointments, and other temporary places. After she has stood for more than an hour, as still as one of the circus statues, a man in a gray suit approaches her. He listens without reaction as she speaks, and when she is finished, he only nods. She executes a perfect curtsy, and then she turns and leaves. The man in the gray suit stands alone, unnoticed, in the lobby for some time. Intersections 1. The Drop of a Hat. London, October 31 to November 1, 1901. The circus is always particularly festive on All Hallows' Eve. Round paper lanterns hang in the courtyard, the shadows dancing over their white surfaces like silently howling faces. Leather masks in white and black and silver with ribbon ties are set in baskets by the gates and around the circus for patrons to wear, should they wish. It is sometimes difficult to discern performer from patron. It is an altogether different experience to wander through the circus anonymously, to blend in with the environment, becoming a part of the ambience. Many patrons enjoy the experience immensely, while others find it disconcerting and prefer to wear their own faces. Now the crowd has thinned considerably in these hours past midnight as the clock ticks its way into All Hallows proper. The remaining masked patrons wander like ghosts. The line for the fortune teller has dwindled down to nothing in these hours. Most people seek their fortunes early in the evening. The late of the night is suited for less cerebral pursuits. Earlier the querents filed in almost non-stop, but as October fades into November, there is no one waiting in the vestibule, no one waiting behind the beaded curtain to hear what secrets the cards have to tell. And then the beaded curtain parts, though she heard no one approach. What Marco comes to tell her should not be a shock. The cards have been telling her as much for years, but she refused to listen, choosing to see only the other possibilities, the alternate paths to be taken. Hearing it from his own lips is another thing entirely. As soon as he speaks the words, a forgotten memory finds its way to the front of her mind. Two green-clad figures in the center of a vibrant ballroom, so undeniably in love that the entire room flushes with heat. She asks him to draw a single card. The fact that he consents surprises her. That the card he draws is La Papessa does not. When he leaves, Isabel removes her sign for the evening. She sometimes removes her sign early, or for periods of time when she is tired from reading or in need of a respite. Often she spends this time with Tsukiko, but instead of seeking out the contortionist this particular evening, she sits alone at her table, shuffling her tarot deck compulsively. She flips one card face up, then another and another. There are only swords. Lines of them in pointed rows, 4, 9, 10, the single sharp ace. She pushes them back into a pile. She abandons the cards and turns to something else instead. She keeps the hat box under her table. It is the safest place she could think of, the easiest for her to access. Often she forgets it is even there, concealed beneath the cascading velvet, always suspended between her and her querents, a constant unseen presence. Now she reaches beneath the table and draws it out from velvet shadows into the flickering candlelight. The hat box is plain and round, covered in black silk. It has no latch or hinge, its lid kept in place by two ribbons, one black and one white, that are tied in careful knots. Isabel places the box upon the table and brushes a thick layer of dust off the top, though much of it still sticks to the knotted ribbons. She hesitates, and thinks for a moment that it would be better to leave it alone, to return it to its resting place, but it does not seem to matter any longer. She unties the ribbons slowly, working the knots out with her fingernails. When they are loosened enough for her to remove the lid, she pulls it off gingerly, as though she fears what she might find inside. Inside the box is a hat. It is just as she left it, an old black bowler hat, showing some wear around the brim. It is tied with more black and white ribbons, wrapped like a present in light and dark bows. Beneath the knots of the ribbon there is a single tarot card. Between the hat and the card there is a folded white lace handkerchief, its edges embroidered with looping black vines. They were such simple things, knots and intent. She had laughed through her lessons, much preferring her cards. They seemed so straightforward in comparison, despite their myriad meanings. It was only a precaution. Precautions are wise in such unpredictable circumstances. No stranger than bringing along an umbrella for a walk on a day that feels like rain, even if the sun is shining brightly. Though she cannot be certain it is doing much more than gathering dust, not really, she has no way to be sure, no barometer on which to measure such insubstantial things, no thermometer for chaos. At the moment, it feels like she is pushing against an empty void. Isabel lifts the hat carefully from the box, the long ends of the ribbons spilling in a waterfall around it. It is oddly pretty for being an old hat and a handkerchief and a card tied up in fraying a ribbon. Almost festive. The smallest charms can be the most effective, Isabel says, taken aback when her voice catches, almost on the brink of tears. The hat does not reply. I don't think you're having any effect at all, Isabel says. Again, the hat has no reply. She had only wanted to keep the circus balanced, to prevent two conflicting sides from causing damage to each other or their surroundings, to keep the scales from breaking. Over and over in her mind she sees them together in the ballroom. She remembers snatches of an overheard argument, Marco saying he had done everything for her, a statement she had not understood at the time and forgotten soon after. But now it is clear. All the emotion in the cards when she would try to read about him, it was all for Celia. The circus itself, all for her. For every beautiful tent he creates, she builds one in return. And Isabel herself has been helping to keep it balanced, helping him, helping them both. She looks down at the hat in her hands. White lace caressing black wool, ribbons intertwined. Inseparable. Isabel tears at the ribbons with her fingers, pulling at the bows in a sudden fury. The handkerchief floats down like a ghost, the initials CNB legible amongst the embroidered vines. The tarot card falls to the ground, landing face up. The image of an angel is emblazoned on it. The word Temperance is lettered beneath. Isabel stops, holding her breath, expecting some repercussion, some result from the action. But everything is quiet. The candles flicker around her. The beaded curtain hangs still and calm. She suddenly feels silly and stupid, alone in her tent with a pile of tangled ribbon and an old hat. She thinks herself a fool for believing she could have any impact on such things, that anything she ever did mattered at all. She reaches down to retrieve the fallen card, but her hand freezes just above it when she hears something. For a split second it sounds like the squealing brakes of a train. It takes a moment for Isabel to realize that the noise coming from outside the tent is actually the sound of Poppet Murray screaming. Darkest Before the Dawn. Concord, Massachusetts, October 31, 1902. Poppet and Widget stand by the circus gates just out of the way of the ticket booth, though the line for tickets has waned in the late hour. The star-filled tunnel has already been removed, replaced by a single striped curtain. The Wunschstrom clock strikes three times behind them. Widget munches on a bag of chocolate-covered popcorn.
"What's your fame for him?" he asks, with his mouth mostly full. "I tried to explain as much as I could," Poppet says. "I think I made an analogy about cake." "Well, that must have worked," Widget says. "Who doesn't like a good cake analogy?" "I'm not sure I made any sense.
I think he was most upset that I asked him not to come tonight if he wasn't going to leave with us. I didn't know what else to say. I just tried to make sure he understood it was important.
Poppet sighs, leaning against the iron fence.
And I kissed him, she adds.
I know,
Widget says. Poppet glares at him, her face blushing almost as red as her hair.
I didn't mean to, Widget says with a shrug. You're not hiding it well at all. You should practice more if you don't want me to see things. Didn't Celia teach you how to do that?
Why is your sight getting better and mine's getting worse?
Poppet asks.
Look.
Poppet rolls her eyes.
Did you talk to Celia?
She asks.
I did. I told her you said Bailey was supposed to come with us. All she said was that she wouldn't do anything to prevent it.
Well, that's something.
She's distracted,
Widget says, shaking his bag of popcorn.
She won't tell me anything, and she barely listened to me when I tried to explain what we were asking. I could have told her we wanted to bring a flying hippopotamus along to keep as a pet, and she would have said that was fine. But Bailey's not coming just for fun, is he?
I don't know,
Poppet says.
What do you know?
Poppet looks up at the night sky. Dark clouds cover most of the stars, but pockets of them slide into view, twinkling softly.
Remember when we were on the Stargazer and I saw something bright, but I couldn't tell what it was?
Widget nods.
It was the courtyard. The entire courtyard, not just the bonfire. Bright and burning and hot. Then, I don't know what happened, but Bailey was there. That much I'm sure of.
And this is going to happen soon?
Widget asks.
Very soon, I think.
Should we kidnap him?
Really, Widge?
No, really, we could do it. We can sneak into his house and hit him with something heavy and drag him back here as inconspicuously as possible. We can prop him up and people will think he's a town drunk. He'll be on the train before he's conscious and then he really won't have a choice. Quick and painless. Well, painless for us. Save for the heavy lifting, that is.
I don't think that's really the best idea, Widge,
Poppet says.
Oh, come on. It'll be fun,
Widget says.
I don't think so. I think we already did whatever it was we were supposed to do. And now we have to wait.
Are you sure about that?
Widget asks.
No,
Poppet says quietly. After a while, Widget goes off in search of something else to eat, and Poppet waits by the gates alone, occasionally glancing over her shoulder to check the time on the clock behind her. Intersections 2. Scarlet Furies and Red Destinies. London, October 31 to November 1, 1901. Though any night at the circus can rightfully be called magical, Herr Friedrich Thiessen once wrote, All Hallows' Eve is something special. The air itself crackles with mystery. This particular Halloween night is cold and crisp. The boisterous crowd is clothed in heavy coats and scarves. Many of them wear masks, faces lost in swatches of black and silver and white. The light in the circus is dimmer than usual. The shadows seem to creep from every corner. Chandresh Christophe Lefebvre enters the circus without notice. He picks up a silver mask from a basket by the gates and slips it over his face. The woman in the ticket booth does not recognize him when he pays his admission in full. He wanders through the circus like a man in a dream. The man in the gray suit does not wear a mask. He walks leisurely, with a calm, almost lazy gait. He has no particular destination in mind, wandering from tent to tent. Some he enters, others he passes by. He purchases a cup of tea and stays in the courtyard, watching the bonfire for a while, before wandering back into the paths amongst the tents. He has never attended the circus before, and he appears to be enjoying himself. Chandresh follows him every move, every stop, pursues him through tents, and watches him pay for his tea in the courtyard. He stares at the ground near the man in the grey suit's feet, looking for his shadow. though he is thwarted by the ever-shifting light. Other than Chandresh, no one pays him any notice. Passers-by do not look at him. Not even a glance is spared, despite his height and his pristine grey suit and top hat. Even the girl who sells him tea